Hi, this is Bob Kohler for the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This episode is brought to you again by the Great American Magic Company.com, the place where customers come first and their customer service is unrivaled. And we'll probably talk a little bit about that later in the podcast, and you'll see why. I also want to thank the Friends of the Magic Word, whose financial support has assisted in helping make these Las Vegas Chronicles possible, because they've helped to defray the travel and lodging expenses while we were traveling in and out of Las Vegas and going around to visit all of these guys. And so this is the second in the installment, here with Bob Kohler, last week being Stan Allen, and we have a lot more coming up into the future months. And I know if you enjoyed Stan's last week, you'll enjoy Bob's this week, and then next week we'll be talking with Fielding West, and so I know you'll be enjoying that as well. So anyhow, this week with Bob Kohler talks a lot about the development of some of his magic and his pro magic line, and including his Ultimate Three Fly and the Bob Fitch Holdout. In fact, talking about the Fitch Holdout, it's interesting, there was a feature article, a cover article with Bob back in February 2003 on Magic Magazine, where they were talking about the California Trade Secrets Act, and so much of that article was more about the development of trying to keep that trick a secret, basically, rather than kind of about his background. But Bob and I go way back and have known each other for a very long time. What's interesting, I think, is that how late Bob got into magic and how quickly he rose within the ranks, and rightly so. He is not often seen in the magic community performing, and so if you ever get an opportunity to see him at a convention or someplace, I would highly recommend it. He has really great performing chops, good close-up guy, very nice fella, and very creative as well, and he is a aligned himself with some great people too, and he has helped bring out some of their products. I mentioned Bob Fitch, but also Scott Alexander and Daryl and others. And speaking of Daryl, by the way, when we had recorded this back in early February, of course, that we didn't know about what was to come, although we knew that Bob Cassidy was in hospice and was not doing well. But we certainly didn't expect the passing of Daryl. That was a tragedy will affect the magic community for many years to come. And so, anyhow, Bob had done several projects with Daryl in the past, the main one being Secret Sessions. And that was a series of videos of some really great close-up guys back in the early 1990s. And there is a link on this podcast blog at themagicwordpodcast.com, where you can go down and you can click on that, learn a little bit more about it. It's available through Marietted Magic. So I suggest you go and check that out then too. But anyhow, Bob has been kind of behind the scenes in helping to film and release some really top magic, and help also have limited run releases of some things that once they're gone, they're gone. And they're well made, and they're not for collectors, although probably collectors do collect these things, but they're really made for the working pro to be used over and over, because they are resilient, they're well made. Well, again, I'm kind of getting way ahead of myself, and I'm going to let him talk for himself, and so let me introduce my friend, and soon to be yours, Mr. Bob Kohler, here on The Magic Word. This is Scott Wells for themagicwordpodcast.com, and I am excited here in Las Vegas to be visiting with Bob Kohler. Bob Kohler is a friend I've known for quite some time. Many of you know him from his products, perhaps have seen him perform at some place or another, or as in a speaking engagement, and he has a fine line of products as well. I was going to talk to you also about some of your coins and things that you've made as well on that. So thank you for welcoming me into your home here in Las Vegas. It's lovely, and so let's welcome, please, Bob Kohler. Hi, Bob.
Well, welcome to Lost Wages.
That's right, Lost Wages. Well, you do have a nice home, and you were saying that actually this was kind of on the outskirts of town, I guess, at one time. You had a great view. And
yeah, one time when we first moved into this house in 2004, there were around 750,000 people in Las Vegas, and then the wave hit, yeah, and we jumped to 2.1 million. So things have grown, as they say.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're in a great neighborhood, close to the airport, close to the Strip. It's a wonderful city. Don't move here.
Now, do you? Yeah, it's kind of like people who live in Hawaii say, come visit, spend your money, leave your tourist dollars, but don't stay here.
Right. Yeah. One thing we say about Las Vegas is the summer temperatures are hot.
Yeah.
Last summer, very hot. And we call that population control. Otherwise, this would be another Los Angeles.
Well, I can understand that, certainly. And that was what Stan Allen was talking about earlier when he'd moved from Los Angeles, how the on the salary of two teachers, you know, they could live under the freeway in an apartment someplace as opposed to coming out here and having a nice home.
You know, it's funny that you say that because Stan's the person that got me to move to Las Vegas.
Oh, really? Okay.
He told me about Green Valley, and I ended up moving very close to where he lived.
Yeah.
And I lived there for my first home.
Yeah?
Yep.
And since you've been here, do you do a lot of traveling out of here and use this as your base, or do you do a lot of, over the last several years, you've been working here?
Well, for me, I was a late bloomer in magic. I didn't start until 1980. Mm-hmm. So I was 30 years old when I got into it, and my career took me through D.C., Florida, back to D.C., then Los Angeles for about 10 years. And I ended up in Vegas in 1996, and at that time, I was still doing a lot of air travel. So I was looking for a hub that had really good flights, and I was definitely going to stay somewhere out west. We looked at every city and ended up just choosing Las Vegas for a variety of reasons. It was a great choice for us.
Yeah.
Back then, at my first house, I was literally 10 minutes from leaving my house and arriving at the gate.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
This is before, of course, you know, all the changes in air travel.
Yeah, air travel. Yeah, exactly.
And I basically kept traveling until after 9/11. 9/11 was a big paradigm shift for me because I started doing magic products a little more seriously in 1996 with Aces in Their Faces. Before that, I worked with Daryl and Rick Thomas. Well, actually, I worked with Daryl and Rick Thomas right after that for about 9 months.
Now, those are about as diverse as you could imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, Daryl being close up and Rick Thomas being the huge illusions.
Yeah, but we had different things in common.
Really? You know?
Well, when I was living in Los Angeles, Daryl was a great friend of mine, and we both had a lot of material, and we thought, well, let's put it on video.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, our schedules were just horribly mismatched, and he was always traveling or I was, and it really took two people to do it back then.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't do too much. We only did three tapes that were called the Secret Sessions that we shot at Fectors twice and then an IBM convention. And we got all of our pals, and we had all the superstars. We had everybody from Juan Tamariz, Michael Weber, Paul Gertner, you name it. Those little tapes are awesome.
Wow.
Because you see some of the early developmental magic of a lot of guys, Giovanni Lavera, on and on and on. I mean,
are those still available?
Oh, yeah. We sold it to Murphy's. Murphy's, I believe, still has it on a DVD format. Yeah.
And they're called Secret Sessions?
The Secret Sessions, I think it's 1, 2, and 3, but I think they're all on 1 or 2 DVDs. They squished it down somehow.
Now, I remember talking with you so many years ago. You were always on the forefront, it seems like, of video editing. Because I remember, golly, what year would this have been? You were talking about the suitcase or so. What was that called?
The video toaster.
Video toaster. Thank you. That's what it was.
The video toaster.
Now, what year would that have been? That would have been the
80s? That was around, no, not the 80s. That was probably 1991 was about when it came out.
Okay.
And Penn and Teller picked one up, and they were playing with it. Also, another pal of mine, Todd Rundgren, the musician.
Musician, yeah. Bang on the drum all day, yeah.
Todd is awesome. He was really the guy that started the whole revolution because he was the first musician to make his own music video on MTV.
On MTV, really,
yeah.
Okay.
And then he got into the video toaster, and I met Todd through the video toaster, mm-hmm. and we shared you know, some musical traditional stuff, too, since I used to be a musician.
And that was in Los Angeles, obviously.
This was in L.A., uh-huh. right. And L.A. was the hub for the video toaster, believe me. Everybody that had it really was out there. Very difficult to use, and that got me my feet wet. Mm-hmm. And I really loved it, except me and Daryl never really got it rolling. Like at the time, A1 was just starting, Louis Falanga was just starting. So we were really at the forefront of it, but we just didn't have the time. We both had careers with a million shows, and the shows were really paying the bills, and it was more of a quest, let's call it, because it never turned into, it was just a journey.
Yeah. So, well, there was more money, perhaps, in doing the shows, and it was more...
Well, way more.
Yeah.
Way more. I think we were making thousands and thousands mm-hmm. doing shows. And
you were doing trade shows a lot back then.
Well, back then, actually, the trade shows for me started in 1985. My friend Tim Conover got me my very first one.
There's a guy we miss.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm looking forward to Eric Mead's new book.
Well, we all are.
Yeah.
I was really one of Tim's very closest friends. We lived in the D.C. area, and we spent just... mm-hmm. every moment together we could. And we traveled a lot and did a lot of the same shows, trade shows especially. And then this is a real left turn, but we got into mentalism in 1988.
Uh-huh.
And that was because...
That's strange. Few people were back then.
Well, there was really nobody.
Yeah. I mean, it was Steve Shaw.
Steve, we didn't know about Steve.
Yeah.
But
we were still trying to make a name, because our partnership began in 87. The first thing we did was Radio Magic.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
So he was just kind of getting his career started. He really had just finished the Alpha Project, so he really wasn't known in the fraternity and mentalism. Talk about not being hot, that wasn't even lukewarm back then.
Yeah, the corporate world for mentalism was just really in its infancy. You know, there weren't very many guys out there playing the game.
Yeah.
Me and Tim were successful at it because I think we looked the right part. We sort of look like banker corporate type of people.
You do. Now, were you influenced by Tim to do mentalism? Because he did great magic, but I always saw him also as holding a crystal ball and doing mentalism kind of thing.
That actually came later. I went to see, I saw Max Maven,
yeah.
and I saw Max do Fogel's Headline Hunter, which is a terrific trick of Maurice Fogel's. And Max has got a great take on it, which I don't believe he's published, so I'm not going to talk about that anymore. But he's got a great solution. And it fooled me pretty badly. So I ended up telling Tim about the experience. And Tim got all excited and started working on it. And the very first mentalism effect that Tim made up came from that conversation. And it's essentially the same effect, just with a whole unique method that's never been published. And it will be in the books, I imagine, once mm-hmm. Eric gets them out.
Right.
So it's actually the one trick I wish would never come out, because it's my favorite trick of Tim's.
Don't you hate that?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's time for us to let go and let other people have it. But it's fantastic, no doubt about it. But me and Tim were on a parallel course. Every day we talked about switching we were doing close-up magic formal shows. I did a lot of shows for Bill Herz and Magic Corps back then in the 80s, and Tim did as well. The A-team was, you know, Williamson, Weber, Bob Sheets, Tim, and me for the most part in the first couple years. And but then we started thinking about stage more. I was already doing stage comedy magic. It was the only vehicle I had.
Hmm. Comedy clubs or corporate stuff?
All corporate. But the mentalism world was talking to us. We started, once that conversation started, Tim taught me the newspaper trick, and I failed miserably at it the first time I did it. So I called him up and I went, your trick's is awful. And he said, tell me exactly what you did. And I told him, he says, you did it all wrong. And then he told me, and then I finally understood what he was getting at.
Uh-huh.
Second show I go out, I did it for 500 Secret Service agents and their wives. And it was the trick they talked about.
Wow.
Out of everything that I'd been doing for, you know, a number of years, and it was pretty solid, mm-hmm. I thought. But this trick blew him away. So that was really the gasoline on the fire for the mentalism world for me.
And so you anchored your show around that trick, basically.
Actually, I did. But as fast as I could, I got rid of all of my comedy magic and turned into a full-time mentalist by the summer of 1989, which is, you know, pretty early.
Yeah.
And Tim was doing the same thing. He was trying to work on a stage act and couldn't come up with even a direction. And ended up going into that mode. He got into the mentalism mode as well. So the mentalism really all of a sudden just felt like a breath of fresh air, because your pockets aren't full of stuff. You don't have loads.
Exactly.
I'm not wearing holdouts. You know, I don't have all these gizmos.
You come with a briefcase and you got a whole show.
Maybe not even a whole briefcase. I mean, once you really get it, you know, tied down, you can make things very, very tiny.
Yeah. What were your powers? I mean, I always talk to Bob Cassidy.
That's a good question. Yeah. That's a very good question. You know, I don't like to limp. I don't like to give people a framework of what they're going to see, mm-hmm. and I also don't want to tell them at the end what they saw. Mm-hmm. I want them to kind of figure out what I was for themselves. So I've tried a variety of different characters and different approaches. My favorite is basically, I used to tell people that I don't have any powers at all, but I'm the world's biggest con artist. And I'm going to con you into believing that I have psychic powers and I can do things that are unimaginable to the normal human being.
So that was your disclaimer, basically.
Yeah, I tried that for a while.
Yeah.
And I still do like that one.
Mm-hmm.
But I also, you know, I've kind of gone, you have to kind of keep shifting with
the
beliefs. Yeah.
You know, that's true.
And it's changed over the years. Now, when I do the stand-up mentalism show, which is pretty infrequently, I only do maybe 4 to 8 of them a year. because now the only thing I really do is I could do formal close-up. Because living in Vegas, I don't want to travel anymore. I've been on the airplanes my whole life.
And the world comes to Vegas, so you don't need to go.
The world comes to Vegas. All the high rollers come here. Yeah. I'm connected with the same people I was connected with for 20 years.
They have the same clients.
So that and new, but you know, I have the same people that basically lead me to the new clients, which is awesome.
That's good.
Yeah, and I don't have to – I'm in a position now where I don't have to do shows to make a living because I've got other things going on. But I still do love doing the shows, and the formal shows I do all of them are 1 hour long, and I have three. I've got a close-up magic, I've got a gambling demonstration, and then I've got a mentalism show.
I tell people over and over on this podcast that they should diversify like that as much as you can, because that way that you have something else to sell the client, because if you just have the one show, they're going to say, well, we had you last year. Yeah, but I've got something totally different that I could do for you now.
Absolutely. That's approach A. Mm-hmm. A second thing, though, that is really cool is that I've managed, at least the way I put it together, all three of those shows fit in the same carry case. So all of it's with me all the time.
Nice.
So when I get to the show, and generally now I'm working for anywhere from 10 to around 35 people. That's generally it, because it's usually in suites. Mm-hmm. So when I get there, I can kind of figure out just by talking to the clients and taking a little conversation before the show with the room, I can figure out what I'm going to do. And a lot of it is easy math. You look at it, and if it's all men, gambling is going to be a strong point.
Mm-hmm, right.
And if it's 50-50, male-female, then magic with some mentalism thrown in. Mm-hmm. And also, the other beautiful thing is I pretty much know how I'm going to begin the show and end the show. And then as I'm going, I can reach in my case and shift gears if I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So
by reading the audience.
By reading the audience and going with what they want.
Interesting.
Yeah. So it's actually, I think, is probably my biggest strength is that I've got this diversity.
Right.
So I rarely get into a situation where they hate me.
Well, we never want to have that.
No, that's not a goal. That's not a goal.
Exactly. So with the other alternate streams of revenue, the things you have that I alluded to, first of all, about the coins and things you make. Do you make the coins here?
No. I farmed all that type of work out. I think when you say the coins, you're probably talking about Ultimate 3 Fly.
Yeah, I am.
That was a big hit. It was pretty much a paradigm shift in the way Chris Kenner's trick was done.
Mm-hmm. Was that your first entree into the coin
making? Yeah, it really was.
Okay.
It's pretty much the only one I've ever really put out. I've got more, but
That's the one that I always think of.
Yeah. Well, it really, the thing that the Ultimate 3 Fly had going for it that made it easier for a lot of people that aren't, the skill level of Chris, because when you watch Chris do it, people have rarely seen him really do his entire routine.
I guess not. Yeah.
He shows the middle section of it, and it's pretty much the same for me too. We even though we weren't discussing the routine, we sort of went down similar paths where we had a production sequence, a middle sequence is what everybody knows, and then there's the ending vanish sequence. It's falls into what I like to call the power of three. Because a beginning, middle, and an end is always a good thing, no matter how many times you can sneak that into your show.
Sure.
Whether it's in a trick, whether it's in a section of a
needs to be structured.
Show, it gives it structure. Yeah. And it also gives a feeling of
completeness.
And
in the audience.
Coming from a musical background, one thing I learned very early on is music feels right when it's complete. And it's usually completed by starting and ending on the same chord. Hmm. Like if you start on a C chord. Well, most people that aren't musicians would never know this, but if just most symphonies, if they're going to start on a certain note, they're going to come all the way through the entire symphony, no matter how many movements, and end up somehow getting back to the starting point to make the audience feel complete.
Right. Wow, it's interesting. I do believe that you should have a start, middle, and finish within each routine within the overall act, and then the act, of course, having those threads all the way through there as well.
Absolutely.
With your peaks, and I wouldn't say valleys, but peaks and plateaus, I should say, of different kinds of things. We just had David Hyra came through Houston and lectured, and he had recently lectured on Penguin and was talking about the importance of connecting with your audience, but he was teaching a thing that was a Houdini rope tie, basically, and having some dramatic music. And the rest of the show is very lighthearted and fun and comedic and everything. But he says, I have this in order to give the audience a chance to kind of breathe and sit back and watch something else or maybe be on the edge of their seats as opposed to laughing, to create other types of emotions. Laughing is not the only emotion that we should ask for in a performance.
Absolutely. Yeah, the audience's memory is going to be a lot deeper and longer lasting if all the emotions are involved.
Yeah, yeah.
No doubt.
Yeah, that's true.
No doubt.
So the coins that you had made that is still obviously very popular are still being made?
No.
Okay.
No, it was on the market for a very short amount of time me,
okay.
I should say.
Okay, there are others who have...
Yeah, other people jumped on the bandwagon, and which so often happens in the world of magic, and unfortunately magicians support people that follow
cheaper.
That path. Well, not necessarily cheaper, but maybe faster availability.
Okay.
That particular trick was very difficult to make, and we had a limit of around 30 sets a month, which seems like nothing, you know, really, in the big scheme of things.
And they were sold for, what, $350 back then?
I think it started off at $3 and then went to $350,
okay.
But my memory could be wrong.
Are they sold anywhere at all on eBay? Do you ever follow it and watch and say somebody's got this for sale for $700 or something now? Or?
I do know that they go, but I don't follow it.
I'm just curious what they could go for now if they... Since they're no longer made.
I think you can still get the actual coins.
Oh, okay.
You know, people make them, and they make all kinds of varieties of them.
But you have not authorized anybody to make it?
I really haven't. No.
Okay.
No, I really haven't. I will say that the one person who hasn't made it and has been really great is Jamie Schoolcraft.
Mm-hmm.
And Jamie's got, you know, incredible skills with making coins.
He does.
He's a good friend. One thing that may surprise people, hopefully there will be a second version of it because the version that came out was version one, and version two has been in my pocket for about 15 years.
Was it just that you couldn't make that before at a reasonable price or that the technology was
available? Yeah, it really came down to changing the thinking a little bit, approaching some of the problem some people had even doing it because it's a self-working gimmick, but it's not a self-working routine.
Slippery Sam.
Yeah,
thing.
It sort of is. It's based off of the cat's out of the bag these days. It's a locking Slippery Sam.
Okay, got
you
it.
Know, so I knew about Steve Dushek's copper silver gimmick many, many, many years ago, and I used it in the early 80s. Got to meet Steve. Steve's one of my heroes in magic. Just a great guy. Really creative.
It's too bad we don't see him developing anything new nowadays.
He's very, very negative about the magic community.
Cornelius, too. A lot of the creators
John
I know.
All good friends of mine.
Yeah.
Yep, sure. I'm trying not to take that negative thing to my grave.
It's easy to do.
It really is. There was a time that was very dark for me, and I was really upset with certain folks in magic. And my wife basically, you know, said, you know, it only bothers you.
It
doesn't bother them.
You can do one of two things: hold it or let it go.
Yep. So I let it go, and I've created a lot of stuff, but it's also, you know, caused me not to release a lot of things too.
Well, that's one thing perhaps it would almost encourage you to go and inspire you to make new things. Like, well, they can have it. They've done it. I'm going to go make something else. But then after so many times, I mean, like with John Cornelius and Steve Dushek and some of these guys, it's like, how many times am I going to just beat my head up against the wall for somebody to go and rip me off or whatever, or have them make it in China or somewhere that is cheaper? And it's like, I've had the original idea. Okay, yeah, I'm known for that, but I'm not making any money on that.
Right,
you know,
right.
A thing would be like with Kevin James with that arm thing that he was doing, you know, and then
no doubt.
Oh my gosh.
No doubt. Yeah, Kevin's been smashed many times.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's not a magic problem that's unique to magic. This is worldwide.
Well, sure. Yeah.
I don't care what widget you come up with. There's going to be somebody somewhere.
Well, you're a musician, and even in music, people are ripping off other people's styles.
Oh, yeah.
But
sure.
But there, at least a lot of that stuff is going to be, you know, through ASCAP or whatever, did you have rights to certain music, certain tunes. You can't have three bars in a row that are going to be the same,
right.
You know, whatever. So there are certain laws,
right.
Whereas we don't have anything.
Exactly. Well, that's not really 100% true.
Okay. Enlighten me.
Well, I was on the cover of Magic Magazine many, many years ago. I think it was years ago, maybe decades ago now.
time flies when you have
well,
fun.
Well, part of the article was because I had come up with, after, running through some of these problems, I'd been holding on to a secret that Bob Fitch tipped me, which was his holdout work.
Yeah.
And then I created a different method of actually functionally building it. So, and I'll answer a question you asked me 10 minutes ago.
Okay.
We don't manufacture a lot of the stuff here, but I do manufacture a lot of the prototypes here. And in certain cases, I do, we'll make certain props. But
so you've got the ability to make shells.
I do. I have the mechanical knowledge to figure out how to get things made or make them myself in certain cases. I'm very familiar with the CNC world. I'm familiar with a lot of manufacturing stuff. So when Bob Fitch first fooled the hell out of me, as bad as anybody's ever fooled me, I had no idea he was even using a holdout. He did it so well.
You don't think of him as using a holdout.
You don't? No. Well, you know.
I do now, but I didn't.
He's also a Toppat master, and Bob is, he's really one of those guys, if you haven't recorded him, you should get him on a podcast, because he's a very deep pond. You could do a week or two of episodes with just Bob.
I have spoken with him. He had lectured at the TAOM, and afterwards I was talking to him about that lecture.
Right,
and,
right.
And yes, we did. We did talk about that. So there's one, yes. And so, you're right. He's got a lot.
Well, he's got a lot because he's the real deal as an actor, professional dancer. He was
one of
the
Tony.
Stars. He was in Annie as Rooster, the bad guy.
Yeah.
And, just unbelievable. And what people don't know about Bob is he's also in about 300 television commercials. Back in when we were younger men, he was on TV all the time. And you never knew it was him because they always had him wearing a mustache or a hat or something. And you never knew it was Bob. But he was in hundreds of them. And I was staying with him one day and he said, here, watch this while I'm going to go to this audition. And he put a tape in and I'm going, I've seen that commercial. And I said that for about 2 hours. And these were all 1 minute commercials.
And you were looking for him exclusively.
Yeah,
this time
he told me he was in there. And I'm like, oh, that's him. That's him. That's him. He's everywhere.
Wow.
But not only that, he understands theater and television and movie production and so many aspects that are so valuable. You know, so anybody
and
that
he explains
can ever,
it so well. I like the way he breaks it down. When he talks about a table, you use this kind of a base and this kind of a top, and then you put this kind of a cloth on it, and then you put this kind of prop on it. I mean, he builds one piece at a time.
Yeah.
And it's like, then makes all perfect sense why you do what you do rather than just grabbing something and throwing it together. He's brilliant.
Well, he fooled me very badly with his holdout. And the trick that really bothered me was he did a coins across where he had four coins in one hand. And then he closed both hands, and then they were not in the hand they were in before, and they had jumped across with no moves. And I thought, exactly.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'm a coin guy. I know all this coin stuff. Uh-huh. I don't know that. And more people came, and he was jazzing, and all of a sudden it happened again. And it caught me off guard because he set it up different.
Uh-huh.
He was setting me up, you know.
Okay.
And so then 15 minutes later, he's still doing jazz stand-up coin tricks, and here it comes again. I got it three times. It's like an axe to my forehead. I had no idea.
Yeah.
So I go back to D.C. I ask everybody. They go, no, I don't know. Nobody knew.
Yeah.
And D.C. at the time was a really hotbed of close-up magic. I mean, we had really great people there.
We'll return to our discussion with Bob Kohler in just a few moments, but I want to introduce you again to Mr. Eric Citron, who is the proprietor of TheGreatAmericanMagicCompany.com. Hi there, Eric.
Hey, Scott, how's it going?
It's going very well. Fantastic. And by the way, that there was something that I just received this last week, and we haven't talked about this, so it might surprise you. And it was an unsolicited email, actually, and the subject was Great American Magic Company. And it was from one of the listeners, and let me just read this. I really hate reading things verbatim, but I think this is important. Just had to write and share my very recent experience with your latest sponsor, the Great American Magic Company. Like most magicians, the last thing I really need is to buy more magic-related stuff, but I found Eric's generous offer of a 15% discount for your Magic Word podcast listeners, with free shipping on orders over $79, too tempting and not to take a look. To my delight, I found the Great American Magic Company offering decks of a card design needed to match some Gaff decks that I had bought and was not able to locate elsewhere. As a magic history buff, I also saw a couple of nice book options that would certainly put me over the free shipping threshold, so I added Alexander, the Man Who Knows by David Charvet to my cart. But right before clicking on the order button, I double-checked and realized that I had recently purchased that book from another source. I therefore switched my selection to the newly released John Henry Anderson, The Great Wizard of the North by Edwin and Michael Dawes, and submitted my order. A day or two later, I happened to look at my order confirmation and found that I had somehow, probably due to improper use of the browser back button, submitted my earlier cart order containing the Alexander book. I shot off a short email to Eric explaining how I'd messed things up and asked if I could somehow shift my order to the Anderson book, despite the fact that the order had likely already been shipped. I offered several suggestions for handling the fact that the price of the Anderson book was several dollars more than the Alexander book, but Eric simply replied, "Not a problem. I'll take care of it. I'm sending you the book directly from my distributor." I'm still not sure how he did it, but the desired book was literally at my front door within 48 hours after I first sent him the email outlining my screw-up. Talk about customer service. The Great American Magic Company certainly has earned my future business. And that was from Fred King. And he said it was okay that I could read that to him. And I just think that is, quite a testimony. We had a listener who had taken advantage of the discount for not only the free shipping over $79, but also the Magic Word $15 discount, and also a new customer because of his customer service. Now, I know that was an exceptional case, but it was something that was quite an experience that he felt it was important to share that. So I thought I would share that with you and the rest of the listeners so you'd know about that too.
Well, I appreciate that. And, unfortunately, it's not an exceptional case. When you're dealing with the public, things like that happen all the time. And, and I actually lost money on that situation with him, but I wanted to make sure that he was a satisfied first-time customer, especially since it came from your wonderful podcast. And we've had a couple of other instances, not from your podcast, but where customers made mistakes ordering and things like that. And in my view, I want to make sure they get the product as quick as possible and worry about the financial end of it, as an aside, because as we all know, there are a lot of choices out there to purchase magic online. And I think customer service is preeminent. And, and here's an unsolicited, Pro Mystic, Craig Filicetti has, I think, the best customer service in the business. And if I can just emulate him in any way, shape or form and provide the customer service that he does to his customers, to my customers, I think we'll do okay.
You would like to treat a customer the way that you would like to be treated.
Absolutely. And, like I said, it all comes down to customer service because, prices are all regulated. They're all, for the most part, they're all, the prices are set from a retail standpoint from the distributors. Mm-hmm. So it all comes down to customer service. And, especially in the world we live in with social media, it's even more important to take care of the customer because, the channels to get the word out, good or bad, are so many more than there ever was. So, It used to be that with different reviews and TripAdvisor and Yelp and all those other kind of things that are available now, I really think that customer service should be the preeminent thing that online and brick and mortar stores focus on.
Well, that's great. Well, I want to thank you for doing the good job that you're doing. And this company has only been in business just for a few months, I think since the first of the year of 2017, and already that you're developing good rapport and good reputation.
Yes, and just as a quick aside, I know you're speaking of Bob Cola, who I admire greatly, and we carry a lot of his effects on our site. Aces in Their Faces and the Black Envelope and the Golden Shells and Vegas Coins and Prime Cut and things like that. And if any of your listeners are interested in purchasing any of Bob's effects, please visit us.
And the place to go would be?
TheGreatAmericanMagicCompany.com.
Thank you very much. And that was Eric Citron. And let's return to hearing more from Bob Kohler.
Yeah. And DC at the time was a really hotbed of close-up magic. I mean, mm-hmm. We had really great people there.
Now, the Inn of Magic, the farm.
The Brook Farm.
Brook Farm. Mm-hmm. That was back during that era, too, wasn't it?
That's exactly when it was. Yeah. I was working at the Brook Farm, and the lineup was, Bob Sheets and Steve Spill were the headliners, yeah. And behind the bar was Scotty York, and Bob would get behind the bar. We had Eddie Goldstein, Tim Conover, John Kennedy, myself, Barry Wood, just a lot of good, and other guys in D.C. that were very good that people don't know. I mean, it was, every night was like a blast.
Yeah.
You couldn't wait to go.
It would be kind of like the Tower Bar and Grill on steroids.
Way on steroids. Because Bob left the Tower Bar.
Yeah, to go to
D.C. To go to D.C. and
become Chevy Chase, Maryland, I guess it was.
Yeah. It was in Chevy Chase.
Yeah, that's right. A suburb of D.C., mm-hmm. isn't it then?
Very,
yeah.
Very nice area.
Yeah. Yep. And what was the demise of that? It just
From what I remember, the demise was it was in a very high-end neighborhood.
Yeah.
And there was a judge that lived right behind it. And they started
– Too much nightlife.
A little bit too much nightlife traffic at 1 a.m.
Yeah.
And he got a zone problem.
And that was the end of that.
No, well, they moved to a new location, but it was never quite the same. They went bigger. It was in a different neighborhood, didn't have quite the same draw.
Yeah.
And anyway.
Speaking of which, did you ever work down at Bill Malone's place in?
No, I never did.
Okay.
Now, by the time Billy was doing that, I had so many clients in work, I didn't need to work anywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was all one-nighters pretty much.
And were you in Vegas at that time and you were kind of traveling around?
I started traveling from the 85 when I was in the Washington, D.C. area for until 89. Then I moved to Los Angeles, stayed out there until 96. And got here in 96 in Las Vegas. So it was travel. And for me, the travel actually started right after college because I got into the musical career with my partner in the band in D.C. that put me through college. Mm-hmm. And we did pretty well. We got lucky. We got hooked up with Dick Clark's production company, ended up playing in Vegas with Dick Clark at the Flamingo Hilton a couple months a year. And then we would do college shows for him as well. And then the rest of the year, we'd fill in some of the blanks and, you know, find other places, and mostly Florida, to work. And that was a great life until I just finally had enough of the music world by 1980. Mm-hmm. So that's when I retired from the music world all at once. Got it. I didn't know what was going to do at all. Had enough money to live for a while, so I just kind of fooled around, and then I hurt my knee. And my brother gave me "Now You See It, Now You Don't."
Yeah, by Bill Tarr.
And that's what started it. I was sitting there shuffling the cards, and he got me some coins, and I went through the first book in about 2 weeks. I couldn't do everything, but I was bored.
Yeah.
I couldn't do the three-star tricks, you know. So, so he went and got me the other one, and I started doing that one. And by the time I got through that one, it was about 6 weeks, and the back of it said, if you like coin tricks, go get Bobo's. So I went to Barry's Magic Shop in Wheaton, Maryland, and there was a young friend of mine named Barry Wood that worked there. At the time, he was maybe 18 years old. And I walked in and left with $350 worth of books in the first day.
Okay.
The first day.
Yeah.
I had one gimmick. I had the Copper Silver Brass Johnson gimmick. Everything else was a book.
Wow. It sounds like you followed the advice that Roger Clouse always gave me. You know, your best advice is to read books.
Well, yeah. I just got lucky that an 18-year-old kid was kind on an old fart, and he, he gave me some really good advice, you know. So, yeah, because at the time I was 30. But the good part for me was I'd been around professional show business, so I had learned how to basically the difference between practice, rehearsal, and then performance. Mm-hmm. So I picked it up pretty quick, and I had the hands from playing guitar to learn sleight of hand, and I really only wanted to do sleight of hand. And the harder, the more fun for me at the time.
Yeah.
I was kind of dumb. I didn't realize, you know, you could take it a little easy on yourself, right?
You started right into the knuckle buster stuff.
Yeah, I did. And, you know, and then when I run into Bob Fitch, you know, and he gets me going on the holdout, that was another weapon that was really powerful. Probably the most interesting thing about the holdout, though, was that we worked on it for – he had it for 35 or 40 years before I got to it. Mm-hmm. And once I guessed what it was, the next year I came back and I did the same trick for him, but I did it a different way.
Yeah.
And to get there, I made 35 different holdouts.
And wow.
So when I got to New York, I went back to the same convention and I tracked him down. He was there. I said, "Mr. Fitch, could I show you the trick?" He goes, "Sure." And I do the trick for him and he goes, he has a puzzled look on his face. So I kind of know I got him a little bit, right?
Cool.
But I said, what do you think? He says, I think I know part of it, but something burned me really bad. I said, well, mine uses a holdout. Does yours? And up until that point, he had never told anybody that he used a holdout. The people guessed, but they never got confirmation. He goes, well, yeah. Uh-huh. And basically it was, I'll show you mine if you show me yours.
Yeah.
So we went over in a corner of the room where nobody was at, and I pulled my sleeve up and I showed him what I had made, and he looked at it like, what? And then he showed me his, and I went, what? And he didn't tell me how his worked. Uh-huh. I just got to see it, and I had no idea how it worked.
It just looked like a contraption of some
steampunk
thing.
steampunk would be kind.
Okay, wow.
It was made in the bowels of a theater on Broadway by the seamstresses. And he told them what he wanted, and they made this thing, and they didn't want to be bothered with it, so they just kind of threw it together.
And it worked.
It only did coins.
Mm-hmm.
It would do one
little thing. It reaches out like
nothing like you would imagine.
Huh.
But it only did coins, but it would do them perfect, and it would do one up to $8.50. And later, you jump ahead a couple years when I actually got to try his on. Mm-hmm. I couldn't even use his because of the way I developed my own stuff.
Sure.
It was a lot different. But I had solved a couple problems that he was just so technically proficient with it. they weren't problems for him. For me, they were big problems. Mm-hmm. So these two problems.
But he wasn't looking at trying to sell that though either.
No,
he just made it for himself.
No, and I wasn't either. Right. I had no intention of ever selling it. When I first started working on it, it was just for me.
Yeah.
So after that developmental stage, you know, not only did I fix the end for coins, I came up with about 12 other ones that did very specific things. And a few of them did universal types of things. So after about 10 years, one day Bob said to me, you know, we ought to put this out and let some people know about it, but keep it very secret, you know, just really vet people, make sure only the right guys are going to get it. Mm-hmm. So we had a little false start where we thought we were going to be able to put it out, and then we realized that the gimmick that started it all, the coin gimmick, we really didn't have a good solution to manufacture it, and to make it took days, which sounds ridiculous, but it really did at the time. Mm-hmm. So Thomas Wayne, years later, falls into my world, and Thomas is a genius guy. He's one of the finest pool cue makers in the world. His pool cues, the most expensive one went for $110,000. Now, Thomas, he's one of the few guys I've ever run into that actually can improve pretty much anything that you throw at him immediately. He's just mechanically a wizard.
His mind's wired that way.
He's really hardwired in a very creative way. But the CNC work, because of the pool cue being a cylinder that's tapered, mm-hmm. he has to be the master of a five-axis type of machine. And that's about as hard as it gets, thinking of five axes to do the machining. So he's doing incredibly tough inlay work on a tapered cylinder.
Yeah, that's true.
So a holdout to him was nothing. When I first started talking to him, I never said the word holdout. I said, I have a thing that needs to look like this. And he would make it and send it to me. He lived in Alaska. So for about 9 months, he was making things for me that he did not know how they went together or what they did. And I left out key ingredients, so he couldn't put it together because I didn't know him very well.
Sure.
So when I finally decided he was the guy for the job, when I told him what he was doing, then we really had fire under the burner, and what we came up with was pretty special. Mm-hmm. So, and this gets back to your original question of how do you protect the magic?
Right.
So, my attorney is an old friend of mine, Jeffrey Cowan, and Jeffrey is over in Los Angeles, and Jeffrey recommended that we look at this thing called the California Trade Secret Agreement to protect the actual workings of the holdout. And the workings of this thing, most people said it really wouldn't work, and that's one reason Stan was very interested in doing this article with me. It was about my career and about my history, but about a third of the article was about this California Trade Secret Agreement. So folks can go back and read the whole thing if they want all the information. But essentially, it was written by California to protect Adobe and Apple. Oh. Because they were writing software that wasn't really quite protected by copyright laws. Specifically, there were ways around it. There were loopholes. Mm-hmm. So this trade secret agreement, you had to make a condition that something was a trade secret. So what we did was I showed the holdout to 20 people that were close friends of mine. I had them sign a document that said this is a trade secret and nothing like it has ever existed before. And they were going to be my witnesses if I ever had to go to trial. Mm-hmm. So actually, the holdouts that are in the world all still belong to me because I didn't sell any. I actually leased them.
Leased them, yeah.
Without term. Okay. So as long as the folks that have them follow the rules, which are essentially don't do it on television, don't show how it works anywhere, that mm-hmm. type of thing. Just the normal things you would do to protect it. Don't share it with other folks. And you're good to go, and I'll never come after you.
But it will come back to you because they're for lease. In other words, they can't resell it.
They can. They can transfer the lease, but they're bound by the agreement. They still can't reveal it because there's a clause in the agreement that's a fiduciary penalty.
Okay, sure.
So that being said, this happened around 2003, and here we are 2017, and the secret's never been revealed. There's no video of it anywhere.
How many of these do you make a year?
We don't make any. We haven't made any in many years.
Okay, so you just have a few that are out there.
I couldn't tell you the exact number. My wife could.
Yeah.
There's somewhere between 1 and 200.
Okay.
A lot of them have the Fitch coin attachment as a that was an add-on, mm-hmm. and a lot don't. So,
could you tell me how much that they were going for?
Yeah, they the basic unit was leased for $2,000, mm-hmm. and the Fitch attachment was, I believe, another $750.
Okay,
and it came with five DVDs for the basic kit, and then the coin attachment came with two more DVDs that had all of Bob's work on it. There were 25 coin routines that he never released before. Mm-hmm. So pretty special stuff and really, really powerful. You've been fooled by it. You don't know it. Not even by me, other folks.
Sure.
I can't name names.
I understand. No,
part of my agreement is I don't tell people who has it, which is very interesting.
Exactly.
So, you know, when you're – but people – once you understand how it works really well, you can watch people's feet and go, oh, okay. Because they follow my way of doing it more than Bob's way. Bob's a graceful dancer. I'm not.
Yes.
So the way I use it is a little more – there's a little bit more of a tell, you know.
Seems like a natural –
well, mine's natural for me.
Yes.
But most people have adapted, you know, my footwork. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay, I mean, that's
so
good enough. Fair
it
enough.
Makes it sense. Because I use my feet a certain way to draw in the crowd.
So you say they're not selling then the three-fly nor the Fitch holdout. So
what a lot of the things I make are short-term runs.
Okay.
We make them for a while, and when I get tired of making them or something else is more interesting comes along or another of a problem exists material-wise, which happens too, mm-hmm. We move on.
Yeah.
Like right now, one of my best-selling tricks of all time was the human phone number. It was the closer of my act for starting in 1988. That was one of my first mentalism things I made up, but mm-hmm. it ended up being my closer.
Yeah.
And I taught it to just three other people, Tim Conover, Michael Weber, and John Stetson. Mm-hmm. Only the four of us did it for many, many years. And then it started leaking, and I decided to put it out. And so it became really, I would have to guess, and this is a guess, but I would guess that it's probably the number one closer for mentalists around the world. We've sold a lot of those.
And they're like 350, I think, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But we're starting to run into a little problem now, too, because it's a digital age and phone books are starting to get more difficult to get.
That's true.
But you can still get them because by law, the phone companies are forced
to deliver.
They have to print them if you want them. So it's the
they're
laws
just not automatically
changing.
Delivered to your door.
Not, you're not going to find them at your doorstep like you used to. So mm-hmm. if you get them, you need to collect them. You can go to AT&T, and on their site is a place to order the phone book, and they ship it to you for free.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're ever thinking about doing a phone book test and go, hey, remember when we used to use these?
Yeah.
You know, because the trick is still a great trick.
But you just can't, when you're in your hotel, pull the phone book out.
Well, that was part of the, when we were talking about the lightweight nature of the mentalism show, that was one of the driving forces. I love the concept, but I also love that every hotel room I got in had either a white page book, a yellow page book, or a combination white and yellow page book. Mm-hmm. So I developed five basic methods to do the routine with the same ending.
Mm-hmm.
And the ending,
mm-hmm.
you know, dealt with turning humans into signs. So,
right.
I mean, it's kind of now it's everybody sort of knows about it. But it was really something for me because it was my closer and I couldn't top it with anything.
Sure. So you add that to the headline prediction thing that you were doing
with Tim thing?
With Tim.
Oh, yeah. Well, there was many mentalism routines. In fact, the last 5 years or so, I've been doing a variety of mentalism workshops mm-hmm. here in Vegas with John Stetson.
That's right. After the Mindvention's over, that you guys have something, don't you?
We did it a couple times around Mindvention. Now, because of scheduling and Mindvention, I don't want to step on Danny's thing at all.
Yeah, but yours is a workshop, completely different.
It's completely different. Because of travel, it made sense to put it near there. But it was getting congested. Jeff McBride had something going on, and then Danny started doing some bonus events. And so we just moved ours to a different time, and it's hard for me really to me and John to align our schedules where we can make it work. And we added Lior Menor for our last one this October. That was sensational.
You know, Lior is great.
He's really great. He's been a dear friend for over 20 years. Actually, I met Lior through Tim Conover because Lior had that television program running in Tel Aviv, and he hired Tim to come over as a consultant, and they called me from Tel Aviv. You know, and I was a consulting just over the phone. And then I didn't get to meet Lior until about 1994. I think I met him in Las Vegas at one of the Stevens conventions.
Yeah.
And we hit it off like old brothers. Yeah. And, yeah, he's awesome.
He is. You know, I bought his Knights Tour, and I did that for trade shows for a while.
Yep.
And he actually built something so this way at the end that it would have
yep. –
I'd send him my company's logo. He'd make it for me send it back. Yeah. He was such a great guy.
He is really smart. He's really smart about making the company first. It's all about the company and the product.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, just great. But the workshop with him, having me and him and John in one – spot for 3 or 4 days. It's really something because we all, John and me are a lot closer than, like Lior is more left field than us. His style is more unique. Me and John spent a lot of time together, so there's a lot of rub off.
I can see the two of you.
We both do, we try to get a similar amount of comedy mixed in for the entertainment value, but still have the powerhouse effects.
On a related note about this, and I mentioned Bob Cassidy earlier, we were talking about powers. I understand that he's gone into hospice. Have you heard anything about him, his health-wise?
I haven't heard anything good.
Yeah. I mean,
I did hear I didn't hear about the hospice, actually. The last I heard, he was in a hospital. Mm-hmm. But love the guy.
Yeah,
brilliant. Not known him a long, long time. Just really one of the greats.
Yeah, yeah. And Rick Mal, health seems to be steady, so hopefully we'll see more of him then as well as years progress. I know it's difficult for him to travel.
It's as we get a little older, we're gonna lose a few here and there.
Yeah, yeah. Brilliant minds. Brilliant minds. Just to kind of conclude here, as we reach toward the end, we're sitting here in your video studio then as well. Tell me some more about the kind of. I mentioned the toaster, and I know that you've always
been
on the forefront of this. And so, did you use Final Cut and Final Cut Pro and all that? I mean,
sure.
Absolutely. So, what are you using now, and what are you?
Now I'm using Blackmagic cinema cameras. They're very cinematic.
Which is what they use actually to make movies, to make the films. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm using, for editing and color correction, I'm using the DaVinci Resolve, which is a Blackmagic product now.
That'd have a steep learning curve, I think.
Very much.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was like relearning the whole video game.
Gosh.
The lighting is actually the hardest part.
I admire you. Holy cow.
No, I've learned a lot. Some of it's been painful, but I do enjoy it. But I think that, what we're shooting for, my whole magic company, really, it's not all magic. Obviously, there's mentalism as well. But I want my product line to be aimed at professionals. So mostly what we sell is called the Pro line.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been working with Scott Alexander for years. One of the benefits is, besides him being a dear friend, a long-term friend, is that he's been doing cruise ships.
Mm-hmm.
And we work on a lot of these products together, then he has the ability to, and most of these are stage. So he can go out on the cruise ship in front of 1,000 people, do it, and refine it until we really get it right.
Yeah.
So we've put out a line of tricks. I'm going to say this without ego. I know this is going to sound like there's ego, but there's a lot of folks out there, their whole show has really come off my website because the tricks are that powerful.
Mm-hmm.
It's a
plug and play.
You certainly are. We hope people will modify things and make it
their own.
Sure. Absolutely. But how much they do, we don't know. We'll never know.
What? Like you got what kind of things out right now?
Well, the latest one came out was Singularity, which is the classic of a ring inside of a walnut, inside of an egg, inside of a lemon. It is a sensational solution to it. Extremely practical. We've got a lot of new work, and you actually see the walnut inside of the egg. You crack the egg open, and you can look through a viewing hole that you've made and see the walnut inside.
Hmm.
And the spectator can crack the walnut themselves.
Huh,
and the evidence
different.
Is pretty much all gone. Well, this will fool you. If we've got time, I'll show you the movie.
Okay.
It'll take you down. It's pretty good. We've only been putting out 2 to 3 a year.
Mm-hmm.
Last year was Himber Ring year, so we put out The Missing Link. And The Missing Link is a stage version of the Himber Ring where everybody's on stage. You go into the crowd to get the people with their rings, but then all of the action actually happens on the stage. So all the verification process, everything is completely visible to the whole audience. And what really sells it is you can really see the people's faces. Now, I know Bruce Irvine did it in the parlor years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Scott came up with a remarkable beginning linking sequence that got my juices flowing. It's one of my favorite all-time tricks anyway. I had a lot of methods myself. We took the front end of what he came up with and melded it in with the way I closed, and mm-hmm. we put this together over the course of about a year. And it's really practical, but it's really a fuller.
That sounds interesting, because I've been doing it for the longest time myself, you know, since Richard Osterlund came out with that routine. And
sure.
I've done it for celebrities, and I used to work at Magic Island, different places.
It's
and I
hard still to have beat.
It is very hard to beat. I've had this discussion with Nick Lewin. Nick's got one out then also.
And I
that
do know
his
Nick's.
Opinion is that you should have, I think it's five rings that he uses.
Right.
Because he's saying that there's too much heat. If you have three, then the obvious thing is subliminally, even if they're not thinking it in the front of their mind,
right.
that there must be some ring they switch in the middle. But
right.
if you use more rings, then they don't know which one it could possibly be.
But my counterpoint to that, though, I've seen Nick do it, and in his hands, it's a miracle.
Yeah.
In my hands, it would be confusing just mm-hmm. because of my style. But what the missing link brings to the table is clarity. So everything is canceled either before or after the fact, and the believability of it just goes through the roof.
Yeah.
And the links, the initial link, I think this is actually on the website on our trailer, but you take the three barred rings around a pencil, you drop them into your left hand,
yes.
and you bring up one ring, you just dip down, and
really?
it links to the second ring,
and
then it links to the third ring, just as fast as I just showed you.
Wow.
And it looks just like that, because that's really what's happening.
Huh.
So, and then everything is test conditions all the way around. That's pretty much the way we operate. Everything's test conditions.
So with the video, are there gimmicks to go with it?
Yeah.
Okay, you get the whole movie, it's ready to go.
We make a special, we make a gold version, and we make a silver version of the Himber ring.
Mm-hmm.
We've solved a few problems that I thought that existed in previous versions.
You say we, you mean Scott and Alexander?
Me and Scott, yep. We work together very much 50-50 on this one.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, you know, I have more thoughts. Sometimes he has more thoughts. But generally, you know, he's great. He's really great to work with. And
he's a funny guy, too.
Scott's
great.
I
love his lecture. Actually, I don't like his lecture, because every time I hear his lecture, I end up buying stuff. You know, I don't buy things from
That's
many
the
lectures.
Idea. Well, you book lecture tours, so yes, you should get some of it for a discount, maybe.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, he's got good stuff.
So that one's out there. We're working with Steve Spill right now on one of Steve's oldest tricks, which is called grab and stab. It's a version of like Russian roulette using knives.
Hmm.
And Steve was the first person that we know of that ever used knives in that way in 1972.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've gone to the foundry. We've had special knives made. This will be out probably in about a month, maybe a month and a half, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting there. I finished the video. It's on the computer, but it's not edited yet.
Well, you say a couple a year. Is it because of how much time it takes you to edit them together,
or
ideas that you just kind of?
It's other business
projects.
Things that keep me busy. I have a guitar invention that's patented, and so that's on the market. I deal with that. I do consulting work for a bunch of folks that are
magicians or musicians
both? Mostly. It's a little bit of everything. It's kind of hard to pin it down. It's sort of like Who Falls in My Lap from my world.
Okay.
No, seriously, though. It's I have some guys that are in business in the guitar world business that I consult with on websites and just how to deal with their products and certain problems they're running into. I do work on people's shows with them. I guess most notably, I work with Apollo Robbins a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Dear friend who's been around me since he first got to Vegas in 96, same time I did.
Yeah.
So we spent a lot of time together, and he's just killer.
Yeah.
Killer performer. So
he travels a lot.
He's traveling a lot.
A ton, yeah.
A lot. Yeah, he's got the miles adding up. And,
yeah.
Him and Ava just had a beautiful baby.
Oh, did they?
Maya.
Didn't know.
Yeah, just in November.
Mm-hmm.
So he's a new dad again.
Yeah,
so.
Right.
So
that may keep
great.
You closer to home for a little while, I think.
No.
Okay.
Now that somebody's got to pay for the baby food,
So
they're just fabulous, and so he's working a lot, and I get tied up with my old clients a bit too. They actually, I'm an out of the box thinker, and they kind of know it. So I get brought into certain environments, and people say, "Well, what do you think?" And it's usually about a subject I know nothing about.
But they think you're the guy.
Well, no, what they're looking
different,
for,
fresh perspective.
They're not looking for a guy that's an engineer or a somebody that really knows the subject matter. Mm-hmm. They're looking for somebody that's going to see a flaw that a guy that'll just, you know, they, if you have a heuristic where your brain is jumping from A to C and skipping mm-hmm. B,
yeah.
which is, that's a basic heuristic. Mm-hmm. And that's what I can do. I can look at something and go, well, what about this? And they go, duh. You know?
Yeah.
And once in a while, I'll hit something. So
yeah.
I get a little bit of consulting stuff like that. It's fun. You know, yeah. Life is great. I have
That's
a blast.
Good.
Yeah.
That's good.
I basically play guitar for fun.
Yeah.
I invent magic tricks for fun. This year is going to be probably a little bit less fun because we're going to shoot a lot of video. Mm-hmm. Like I say, I'm starting on 300 items that I've got in my
Holy
notes.
Moly.
Yeah, I've got a lot. A lot of it is...
We're getting older. We need to get those out.
I really do. Some of them are going to turn into products. But yeah, I mean, for the guys out there that are looking for, you know, the pro stuff, they should check out my pro line. And we've got good answers too. Mostly classic plots. You know, Bill and Lemon, we've had several good answers over the years. The one that's out right now is called The Final Cut. I think it's the best one. Mm-hmm. It's the first one we've ever released that made me stop doing the one that I've been doing since 1985.
Yeah, I've been doing a Bill and Lemon since, I can't remember when. I think it's one of the first tricks I learned. It's still, I have different versions, but I've got one I've been doing now for 20 years probably.
That right, like and that's where I was. Yeah. And then Scott came up with this seed of an idea, pardon the pun.
Yeah.
You know, I started working on it with him, and we made a gimmick that just made this thing really happen. Mm-hmm. I'll show it to you when you're heading out.
Yeah, okay.
It's ridiculous.
Well, I'll tell you what, and speaking of heading out, and that I would like to start to wrap up over here, and the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word, and I always like to ask my guests what it is that's their philosophy of life. You know, what is it that you live by that gives you that excitement to wake up in the morning? I mean, what's your word or phrase?
Word or phrase? Boy, I don't know if I could get it down to just a phrase even,
well,
let alone
it could be a long
word.
Paragraph. What is it?
Yeah. You know, what's next? That would be really it for me.
Okay.
Because I'm excited about life. I'm excited about making new friendships and meeting new people that, you know, I think it's great that we're all different. Otherwise, it'd be very boring if we were all the same, you know. And I get to meet some really, really unique people in the circles I travel. Mm-hmm. I mean, from scientific minds to creative minds in other fields to performers to people in television and movies. And, you know, it's just endless. All of it has to do with creativity. And so I'd say that's the other word would be creativity.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, it's kind of like if everybody was like my grandpa, then everybody would be chasing my grandma. You know?
I'll pass.
So everybody has to be a little diverse and be a little bit different. So.
No doubt, right?
Yeah,
no doubt.
Exactly. So, Bob, thank you very much.
Well, this was a pleasure.
Time.
It was a great hang. We don't get to hang often enough
since
you live so far away.
It is a long way away, and I never come here. It's the first time I've ever come here, you know, for this exclusive purpose, you know, just to talk with you and other friends, you know. Usually it's at a magic convention where I do this, like at Factors or something, and pull people away, but it's kind of like, well, this is time away from your other friends, you know, so I kind of feel like I'm really imposing on their time to spend an hour with me to chat. But
Vegas is such a great magic hub.
Oh, I mean,
when you have David Copperfield here and his team, you know, Homer, Lee Wag, and Chris Kenner are two of the smartest guys in magic. Mm-hmm. And then you got Penn and Teller and Johnny Thompson, and when they got Mike Close, that team is really, I mean, really super smart. And, you know, we've got Chris Angel, we've got, you know, all
Matt
sorts
Franco,
of new folks coming into town.
Yeah,
you know, and it's exciting. It's an exciting time again where we're kind of taking back some of the Cirque du Soleil. And there's too much Cirque du Soleil and not enough magic.
Yeah.
And we're getting more and more magic, and the shows are good.
That's a good point. It used to be, it seems like almost every other show up and down the strip were all Cirque shows.
Yep.
You know, so yeah, maybe we're getting back.
Absolutely.
That's good. Well, good. Bob, again, thank you very much. Appreciate your time. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Bob Kohler, and this is Scotty out.
Well, thank you, Bob. I appreciate you being a guest on the Magic Word Podcast, and I hope you, the listeners, have enjoyed this and learned some things along the way also. I think, like with every other podcast, I always seem to find something fascinating in everyone's character and the words that they share with us over here, and I learn a lot. And, you know, there are a lot of things going back in the archives. There are nearly, at this point, 350 podcasts back there. And so, for those of you who have been on this journey with me for a long time, have been enjoying all those, and for those who haven't gone back, if you have time and don't have any other life, you can go back into the archives. In fact, if you go to the magicwordpodcast.com and click on the tab that says archives, you can go back and start looking at some of the things we've had in the past. And or if you want to search, if there is any magician you can think of that you would like to find out if I've had a conversation with them, just click on that and there might be something that will populate there that will show you a link to the podcast where that person was either interviewed or mentioned or talked with in passing at a magic convention or one thing or another. And in that regard, I want to thank Ian Rowland, a buddy of mine over in the UK, who had suggested that I post an archive, and I did. I thought, well, that's a good idea. I don't know why we hadn't done that before, because we have so many things that are continuing to be added to the archives all the time. So anyhow, enough of that. I think that there are a lot of great words that have been spoken by a lot of great people who are still with us and some who aren't, that are worth going back and listening to, even if you heard them, to go and listen to them again. It's kind of like an old book that you can pull off the shelf and reread for another time. I mean, how many times have you read Erdenace, for an example, or whatever? You just need to kind of go back and look at some of the old classics again, Royal Road to Card Magic and others. So anyhow, lots of good stuff there. Recommend going back and doing that. And I hope also that you're enjoying this new series we've got called the Las Vegas Chronicles. This will run us up into the time we'll be heading out to New York for the Fechter's Finger Flicking Frolic. And as such, that I'm going to suspend this for just a little while, kind of put it on a hiatus as I give you the daily updates from the 4F, and then we'll resume that the Las Vegas Chronicles after that. But next week we'll be talking with Fielding West. Actually, I've already spoken with him. Let me say I'll be posting that podcast with Fielding West this next week. So look forward to that one coming this next week. So I'm going to wrap up over here now to say stay well, get booked, and ponder what's next, and be creative. This is Scotty out.